It's the network break. Brew a coffee and spin up a virtual donut and join us for this Packet Pushers podcast on the latest news from the tech industry with analysis, opinion, insight, and the occasional rant. I'm your host, Drew Connery Murray, and with me, as always, is Greg Farrow. Greg, how you doing?
I'm not too bad. It's been a thin week for news, though.
All right. It's a little bit thin. We'll do our best to fatten it up with some pontification and see how it goes.
Because we've never done that before.
Never. No, no one could accuse us of that. And before we jump into the news, I want to thank our two sponsors today. First, IT Pro TV. This episode of Network Break is being brought to you by IT Pro TV. You can enhance your technology aptitude. IT Pro TV is a resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials, and we'll tell you a little bit more about them later in the show. And also thanks to GNS3 for being a sponsor. You can get the GNS3 Academy course, Practical SDN and OpenFlow Fundamentals, taught by David Bomble, for 50% off. And we'll tell you how to do that also later in the show. And now let's dive into the news. Our first story, Brocade is reportedly buying Ruckus Wireless in a $1.5 billion deal.
Wireless has been separate from the campus network for years and years because it's always been campus Ethernet over here, wireless over here. And to some extent, there's a diversity in skills, that skills that you have as a wired, switching, routing, that sort of thing, is very different from the skills you have with wireless, which is RF and spectrum analysis and RF testing and wireless controllers. So you've had a very SDN-like networking capability to deploy wireless and a whole new set of skills. You know, you need special tools and so forth to make it work. And over here is campus. And there's now the realization, of course, that everybody's moving to what? Wireless.
That's right.
If it's not a smartphone or a tablet these days, people don't want it. There's been several moves over the last 3 or 4 years where companies have bought up smaller wireless vendors to sort of say, yeah, we've got some wireless, but we don't do serious. HPE, for example, bought 2 or 3 wireless companies over the last 7 or 8 years until they finally bought Aruba, which is the big daddy, you know, the main competitor to Cisco's wireless strategy. And people want that one throat to choke, you know, one butt to kick, one sales team to negotiate, I think. And so $1.5 billion later, Ruckus is down in Brocade.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, a growth issue. Brocade didn't have its own WLAN product, and now they've got an entire new market they can sell into. Their choice of Ruckus. Ruckus is growing. According to IDC, it grew 16% year over year in 2005. And IDC also says it accounts for 7% of the enterprise WLAN market. So that gives a Brocade says they now have a new total addressable market of something around $5 billion. Mm-hmm. So that's not bad. And yeah. It also, you know, their big competitors, Cisco and HPE, can say, we've got your complete package, wired and wireless campus. And now Brocade can say, hey, we do too. Yeah. I'm sure over time they're going to be telling a story about integrating the two product lines.
Well, at a business level, it's the same story we always see. A big company buys a product, they put it into their sales force, into the reseller channel that they're building or have. Cisco, of course, is the most effective at this. Buy a product, put it into the sales channel, like Meraki, for example, and turn it from $150 million a year business to $500 million a year in revenue in just 3 years. Mm-hmm. Now, Brocade needs to do that too, right? Because if it's going to cough up $1.5 billion, it needs to turn Ruckus into a big business really quickly.
Yes.
And I think also Ruckus was heavily used by a lot of telcos and service providers. I get the sense that Brocade is as much focused on service provider market as it is on the enterprise market. Mm-hmm. Carriers are very much looking at Wi-Fi and wireless LANs of all different sorts. And the next generation of wireless LANs are actually working in completely different spectrums. So underlying the technology is this 7 to 900 megahertz, which is where the TV channels used to live. And as the TV channels switch over to digital, there's a whole lot of leftover spectrum in that area. At that frequency, down at 700 megahertz to 900 megahertz, you can send a Wi-Fi signal very, very far indeed, very powerful, straight through walls and windows and glass and cars and, you know, and that changes the way that Wi-Fi works. Instead of it being 100 meters from nearest base station and therefore you have to saturate it, we're starting to talk about two things. One, very distances apart for sparse populations, great distances apart, or you can start to use Wi-Fi instead of 4G, 5G, and it's free spectrum, so you don't have to burn up your 4G, 5G spectrum and get very dense cellulars. You can just start to support handsets for data because you can have them close together but very high density. Now, in some capital cities, New York, London, Shanghai, you know, Beijing, you need a lot of people operating. And if you can just take all of their data and offload it to Wi-Fi, then you've got yourself a whole new functionality, a whole new business model, and that's a whole new market.
Yeah, and we're also seeing, in terms of Wi-Fi developing as a market, organizations like, you know, sports stadiums and malls and casinos saying, hey, besides providing this wireless service, we can actually start to extract from some value from it, more opportunities to upsell folks, more opportunities to sell a different kind of connected experience to people. And that's all going to run over wireless.
And a business move, put the wireless in the Brocade channel and hope to sell more, a lot, you know, rapidly grow the business for Ruckus. Of course, anybody who's partnered with Ruckus, and this is the other side, of course, is all of these wireless partnerships are all disintegrating. You know, Aruba was partnered with HPE and Dell and Brocade and Juniper. And now... so,
well, that's because everybody's getting their own, right? There's the number of standalone wireless LAN vendors are dropping.
Well, I'm very cynical about partnerships. I know that Cisco particularly has had a big push on partnerships, and Juniper relies a lot on partnerships to get its products into the market. And this is what happens with partnerships. They don't last very long, a year or two, and then something changes and the people fall out of love. Now, excluding notable partnerships like Cisco and NetApp, for example, around their FlexPod product line, the love affair doesn't last very long. And in my sense is that I would recommend to people don't bet on a partnership. Just because you've got two companies saying, oh, yes, no, we've signed a partnership agreement, we love each other, doesn't mean that they can't break up like a teenage romance next week.
That's right. Keep checking those Facebook status pages on relationships.
Whereas Brocade married Ruckus.
They have married. That's right.
Yeah, there's no half measures here.
They put a ring on it.
They put a ring on it, yeah.
All right, moving on. Cisco posted a blog, a little bit convoluted. It took me a minute to read through the first couple of sentences to figure out just what the heck they were talking about. But apparently, Nexus 3000 line has sold 10 million ports. Hooray for you, have a virtual donut. But the real thrust of the post is that because the 3K is built on merchant silicon, Cisco's saying, well, that must make us the largest bright box that is a branded white box vendor in the world.
Yeah, it's amazing how you can slice and dice a market category and call yourself the largest, can't you?
Yes.
Yes. So Dell and HPE and Juniper, of course, all have branded white box products, but they're not offering them to the general market, as I understand it. It's not really intended for enterprise consumption. It's much more intended for cloud providers who don't want to go and buy their own switches. They want to have... but they want to get the advantages of the flexibility of an open source operating system on branded hardware. And of course, that is the branded hardware, has the vendor support, the vendor has the worldwide network, you have a telephone call. If you're a mid-sized player, you don't have enough people on hand sitting in those data centers. You might have, like, you know, 10 racks in a colo in Singapore, and if something goes wrong, you want to ring up a vendor and get them to take a switch out the site. And that's where the Brightbox category wins. What is noticeable, of course, is that Cisco's not saying is that 25% of switches sold in 2016 were white box as total. So the IDC reports we've seen point out that, you know, Cisco probably only has about 60% of the total non-white box market, and that white box is absolutely in no way the second largest switching vendor in the world today.
Right.
By several times larger than the nearest competitor.
Yep.
So a Pyrrhic victory, perhaps. So, yes, it is the largest bright box. Cisco Nexus 3000 is the Broadcom silicon inside a box running the Cisco operating system that everybody's familiar with. Done very well to sell 10 million ports. Be interesting to know how many boxes that was, because with 48 ports and 24 ports and so forth, and there's been several different iterations of that switch. But I'm not too surprised. Cisco remains 65 to 80% of that market. People are buying it because they're buying it, not because they're buying Cisco's particular product. It's not because it's the best in the world. It's just Cisco sometimes.
Right. To me, this blog tells me that Cisco's, you know, feeling some heat from the white box market. And so they're trying to, one, tout that, hey, we sort of play here too because we also run on merchant silicon. So, you know, don't just discount us. And they also, you know, they called out a few reasons why they're selling so many of these ports on the Nexus 3000. And one is they said it's open programmable OS, which is a signal to me to say, you know, that's the reason folks are buying a white box switch, is because they can do what they want with the operating system, put the operating system in they want, and then have operational controls around it that you don't necessarily get with a traditional vendor product. And so I think Cisco's feeling some pressure there as well.
So the API might be open in the sense that it's published on Cisco's website behind a login, so it's not very open. But the operating system certainly is not. So Cisco, the iOS that runs on the Nexus 3000 is not open source. You can't get access to it.
Right.
The only thing that's open is what Cisco lets you have, and it calls it open. So I dispute the open programmable part. It's not either of those. And generally, Cisco is providing its best support for its own APIs, not for the open APIs. That is, it's not contributing to a wider API initiative. So a little bit of gilding the lily, perhaps.
Yes. Also called marketing.
Yes. So, but fair enough. Knock yourselves out.
Sure.
But Cisco is going to be the biggest. People trust them. People have incumbencies. Things aren't going to change in a hurry. People don't want to change in a hurry. Networking's not that important in terms of the overall, architecture of the data center. People have much more time to spend with, VMware or whatever. So that's what they do.
All right. Well, we're also going to be coming back to a Cisco story about its an actual open source project later in the show, but that's a little teaser for you. Mm-hmm. Moving on, you pulled out this story. Should Apple build their own cloud? I guess apparently Apple is having trouble scaling up its infrastructure to handle all the traffic that its services get. And so this story talks about how they've messed around with commercial off-the-shelf network gear without a lot of success.
What Apple's been doing is there was a big foo-foo about people who care about such things, about whether Apple should be using Google and using AWS. And ultimately, I think what people are missing out on, of course, is that Apple's just so phenomenally huge. When you've got a billion users, you end up with an awful lot of, just so much stuff. I don't think Apple could build data centers fast enough if the truth be known.
Sure.
So why would it not, why would it do these things?
Well, I mean, you could also say that Google, Facebook have billions of users and they seem to have handled it okay. Of course, their whole business was built around serving users over the internet, whereas Apple, eventually that they got to there because of the services that they're selling, but their primary focus is their hardware platform.
Well, the thing is, it takes, takes several years to build a data center. This is the thing that if you're building a data center at Apple's scale, remember, Apple's operating at an enormous scale.
Right.
It takes 3 to 5 years to build a data center, assuming you've even got planning permissions and land purchased and, buying a couple of acres of land to build a data center on in a certain location and getting electricity supply agreements, that takes years.
Mm-hmm.
That's not, oh, I'll go and buy a data center type thing.
Right.
And to make them work at Apple scale again, you can't just go and buy somebody else's existing data center and refit it. You have to do the whole thing from the ground up. So I don't think Apple's done a good job of being in the cloud in the sense that there's no pipeline of production. Now, the flip side of this, of course, is Apple's not very good at cloud itself in that its main business focus is around building handsets. So if you take a look at, our Apple iPhones, its business is around creating millions and millions of tiny, tiny devices that people want to buy. Building a cloud infrastructure is a business problem because they've got to build one massive thing that can be used by billions of customers. Uh-huh. It's the inverse. And the article that high scalability that Todd is talking about here is sort of highlighting the business focus that you have to be able to go from, if your business is all totally and utterly focused on this one thing, iPhone, tablets, laptops, then all of a sudden to build a cloud services strategy, you need to be doing something special to let that business work independently of the other one. You have to have the CEO, the executive teams need to be able to adapt to let that business do its thing. And Apple may not have the DNA to be able to ever do cloud. That's what these articles are talking about.
They say that, but I also felt like, Apple made its bones on the fact that we need to customize things to our specifications and do it exactly our way. And that's the whole point of building your own cloud data center, that you can tweak it to your own performance specs and such. So I feel like, the attitude should be there in how they want to do things. I don't know why they haven't been able to pull it off so far.
You need a focus on that thing. The success of AWS has been that the whole AWS is just doing one thing, building cloud. Mm-hmm. They aren't, the retail business is over there. They haven't pretended to be anything but just this. Google compute platform, the public cloud part of Google hasn't been very good because most of Google's effort is in running search engines or Google Docs or Google Mail, right?
Uh-huh.
And then the ability to just start saying to people, here, have my compute, And to focus on that exclusively is not something that has been easily done. Google's given it a chance this week by hiring Diane Green, who was the founder of VMware. Mm-hmm. And Diane Green, now in charge of Google Compute platform, is attempt to try and enterprise ready the Google Compute,
right?
Because it's not as successful as Azure or Amazon or Rackspace in the, you know, in the wider market, because Google's just not able to communicate to customers effectively because it doesn't normally.
Right.
It's like this Nest thing. You've been tracking the Nest thing that happened this week.
What's that?
Bought a thing called Revolve, R-E-V-O-L-O-V.
Okay, yes, I did read about this, yeah.
Yeah, a device, and Nest bought it, and the Dropcam product. And then this week they decided that actually running Revolve is too hard, and they just put a blog post up saying, it'll be turned off in 4 weeks, thanks for coming. And as soon as the cloud platform's turned off, your home IoT baby monitor just dead.
That's right. Like, yeah, I did read a blog post from an irate customer who was like, I've set up this Revolve thing to run all of my IoT devices around my house, and now it's just going to be shut off without any notice, and they won't even just let it run on its own until it dies. They're just shutting it off.
Exactly, and not even emailing people. Like, they've got their email addresses on file because these people have to have access to the cloud platform, right?
Right.
They could easily send them an email and say, I'm very sorry, you know, we're not keeping it running, so sad, too bad. But they didn't even do that. They just posted a blog post and went, yeah, we're turning it off in a couple of weeks. Nice life, you know, whatever. It's just badly, badly done. And they're saying that's because Nest just doesn't have the sort of focus to be able to sustain something year in, year out. And they were so interested in the design matter issue that they forgot that there's people using it. Because normally when you design a pretty thing, you manufacture it, you put it in the shops, and you walk away to the next pretty thing that you design. And therefore, this idea of constantly sustaining an IoT device once it gets out the door is actually quite foreign to most of the designers.
So you're saying Apple may be a hardware company, it may be a software company, but it is not a cloud and services company.
It could be. In the same way, you know, we see the same things in the networking industry across the board. Look at Cisco. It's got all these different business units doing all these different things. What is Cisco good at? You know, the thing is that Cisco has these business units. They all compete with each other, you know, overlap each other. But at the same time, each of those business units tends to do a pretty good job on their own, except for the ones that fail. There's always failures. And Apple either needs to... These articles sort of say Apple either needs to embrace cloud and say, right, we're going to have to be really, really good at this and skill up instead of just making iPhones for a living, or they have to get out of it completely and just pay AWS or pay Azure to run those data centers for them.
Right.
And that's the point, is that Azure said, yeah, sure, we'll build you more compute capacity and more cloud capacity, but you need to pay us because we're basically building it all for you. And if you walk away, we're on the hook. And Apple didn't want to do that. So then it went to Google Compute. So...
So Apple's got some decisions to make there.
I think so. Maybe it's building a lot of capacity, but if it's doing that worldwide, it's going to take time.
Well, bring some of that cash they've got stashed overseas and invested in building a data center or two here in the U.S. We'd appreciate it.
Well, build the data centers offshore. They don't all need to be in the U.S.
All right. Well, let's take a minute to thank our first sponsor for this episode, IT Pro TV. With IT Pro TV, you can gain access to the most important tools that you need to prepare for your IT certification. And Greg, do you want to tell folks about what they can get?
IT Pro TV is an online training company with over 1,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content. And interestingly, adding more every single week. So what they do is they stream the shows live and record them, and then edit them down. You can watch them live as they're recorded if that's particularly taking your fancy, or you can then go into the website anytime, click on a thing, and start watching them at work or at home on your own. Even watch them on your Chromecast, your Apple TV, or your PC, whatever it is that makes you happy. In March, particularly, for example, they added CCNP security, Microsoft Server 2.16, MCSEs, and also some Microsoft SCCVM stuff. But the key thing about it is there's only one low monthly subscription price, a no-hassle cancellation policy. If you don't like it, just cancel it. And there's corporate pricing available, so maybe you can get your company in on the whole deal.
That's always nice. And you can try it free for 7 days. If you sign up, go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code networkbreak30, and you can check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also get 30% off the lifetime of your account, and that's less than $40 a month or $399 for the entire year. So please visit itpro.tv/networkbreak. Use the code networkbreak30. Try it free for 7 days and save 30% off the life of your account. And thanks to IT Pro TV for being a sponsor.
That's a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners.
Just for you listening to this podcast.
Indeed.
All right, you pulled this story out of the ether, Greg. Mirantis scores a huge OpenStack win with Volkswagen.
Yeah, so the narrative for the last 4 or 5 years around OpenStack is that people keep poking fun at it and saying, it'll never win, it'll never be... You know, it's awful, it doesn't work, and I've always said to them, you just got to wait, right? Open source projects take time to evolve and they to do. Become something. And Volkswagen has made a big play around their IT is going all in with the cloud, and they've chosen OpenStack, not VMware. Now, no doubt they've got some VMware in there. I bet they have.
Oh, I bet they've got noodles of it.
Yeah.
Which may be why they wanted to look at an alternative.
Mm-hmm. So as it says here, because it saw a couple of problems with the public cloud offerings, including a lack of features it specifically needed to use for its use cases, said the corporate director of IT services. Given the scale of our use case, we would need to have a private cloud at some point. We also knew that our private cloud would require more work. As we pursue a trade, we aim to tackle the hard problems. Basically, what they're saying is public cloud doesn't do what they want, so they're going to build their own. And he's under no illusions as to how hard building a private cloud and OpenStack will be, but that's what we're going to do. But importantly, they've chosen Red Hat and Mirantis to do that. So they've bought a commercial OpenStack distribution to get them on the first path down that road.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting. I mean, that's big. I think the deal came up at like tens of millions. It's not... You know, $1 million order, it's sort of tens of millions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely a great win for Mirantis and certainly for OpenStack, you know, trying to change the narrative around the difficulties associated with it. It's, you know, kind of hard to use, kind of a little bit confusing to put all the pieces together. So to get a marquee customer like Volkswagen committing both to OpenStack and Mirantis, I think I agree with you that it talks about the evolution of OpenStack as a platform.
Definitely. It's fascinating to see OpenStack mature and start to find its spot in the market, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm sort of think I'm seeing is that OpenStack is – and I was talking to a couple of people over Twitter this week, and they were saying how OpenStack has really matured in the last few years, and particularly in 2016, and gotten to the point where it's ready for the mainstream. So maybe if you're looking at a cloud project, you could start to consider it.
Absolutely.
It's nearly time for the enterprise that it could fit, you know.
And talking about the enterprise, this is a story that I found from the New Stack. It's about a startup, ContainerX. They're offering a container management platform for the enterprise. And according to ContainerX, they want to be the vSphere for containers. And that makes sense to me. An enterprise-focused container management platform, make it friendly, make it easy to use, get rid of kind of the scruffy edges that come with open source projects. The issue, I think, is whether there's going to be sufficient container uptake in the enterprise in the next, 5 years to support a for-profit company like that. You know, as we were talking about OpenStack, that's taken years to develop. We hear tons about containers, but it's still early days here. There needs to be a lot of evolution. Mm. And frankly, one thing I'm hearing is that a lot of enterprises just don't have the operational processes and maturity in place to take advantage of containers. And so buying container management platforms kind of like putting the cart before the horse if you can't even, use them.
Mm-hmm.
But good luck, ContainerX. Always good to see some startup activity in this space, and that's the kind of thing that can help drive an industry forward.
I think these sorts of moves start to make the whole system – you're seeing the maturity of these things. Instead of seeing things as bits and pieces, like 20 years ago, we started off with routers and hubs, and they were from two different companies. And then eventually these products commoditize and converge, and nowadays we have switches built into our routers, or nobody thinks how hard it is to connect a switch to a router, or even further up the food chain, we're just replacing the whole router thing with an SD-WAN appliance, which does a dozen different things.
Mm-hmm.
So containers, today we're still focused on the container, but we're rapidly moving past that to think about them as fleets of containers. So how do you organize 1,000 containers? How do you structure them effectively? And that's the transition we always see. It's happening at such fast speed, though, in the case of containers, that it's quite eye-opening. And we're already seeing Cisco, in our next topic, talk about containers being absolutely key to the future of networking, and they have to get on top of that very, very quickly.
Well, the benefit for containers is that, you know, they sort of had the market laid, you know, those roads laid for them by the virtualization movement, which, you know, 15 years ago, if you had said, hey, here's a piece of software to let you take your operating system and application and move from one physical server to the next, you'd be like, no way. But you know, everybody does it and it's easy and people know how to do it and it's just the way things are done. Yeah. Containers are going to be able to, you know, stand on the shoulder of virtualization.
Yeah,
that development process.
Like SDN, one of the interesting things about SD-WAN is that I've been steadily learning more and more about companies who've been doing SD-WAN since the late 1990s or the early 2000s and have been putting SD-WAN products out there for many, many years. And yet I never even heard of them or knew they existed until SD-WAN. And it took software-defined networking in the data center to make the SD-WAN market viable. And so with containers exists or is seeing rapid adoption because customers have been educated through the process of virtualization using software to replace hardware effectively.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that as well. We've got another sponsor for this week, GNS3, and let's thank them for being a sponsor. You probably know GNS3 for their Network Lab software. Well, they've also started a training academy, and right now the GNS3 Academy is including the Practical SDN and OpenFlow Fundamentals course from David Bomble. And you, as a Network Break listener, you can get 50% off. So if you're looking to get practical, hands-on, real-world approach to learning and implementing SDN and OpenFlow, this is the place for you. The course offers a unique way to learn about SDN. You don't have any risk. You just use your laptop with some free demo software. And this course, the instructor is a CCIE emeritus. He demonstrates SDN and OpenFlow in detail, covers everything from basic definitions to capturing messages Wireshark, and he'll even show you how to build your own SDN switch with a Raspberry Pi. So the first 50 Network Break listeners to register will receive the course for 50% off. You can register at academy.gns3.com and use the coupon PacketPushers, all one word, to get your discount, and we'll also have links in the show notes to help you get there. Thanks to GNS3. All right, back to the news. Verizon is reportedly making a bid to purchase Yahoo. And when I read that headline, I thought, why?
Because Yahoo's broken.
Yeah, but then, well, why would you buy it if it's broken?
The general consensus is that, remember that Verizon bought HuffPo and a bunch of AOL for content?
Content and advertising, yes, an advertising network, yeah.
Now, keep in mind that telcos can actually extract raw data from the network itself and sell that to advertising people. Mm-hmm. And then if you start to own the advertising and the network, you've got this massive amount of control and insight into what customers want. And theoretically, when it comes to things like ad tech, like what ads do you want to see, the more content you own, the platforms you own, the greater the end. If you see where they're coming from on the network, you can exploit those customers a lot for profit, a lot heavier. I've said this many times, but there's a blog post out there. Verizon, there's a total market for $24 billion in 2014-15 on selling real-time data to ad tech companies about your traffic as it crosses the network. So they're actually breaking into unencrypted data, logging that about you, associating it with your Verizon account, and then selling that to ad tech companies. Well, if you can own the content on the end as well, then your chances to improve your ad tech performance is quite high. And, of course, Yahoo's got a massive amount of content.
They do, but it seems like, I don't know, I guess it must be enough legacy users and content that people keep coming back to that they feel like they can make a go of it. It strikes me as odd that they're – I understand the rationale, but it feels like, you know, you're picking up a zombie and who knows if you can resuscitate it.
Well, you don't have to. You just have to keep the content ticking over. Right?
I guess you do. That's true.
If you're starting to make an extra couple of billion dollars a year out of ad tech sales in the back end that nobody sees, then you don't actually need the content to be profitable. It's the extra data for the machine learning and stuff in the back end that you need. That way you win. That would be my guess. Keep in mind, Yahoo has a bunch of assets. It's selling off its Chinese operations to Alibaba, I believe, or searching for a buyer. And it's also got quite a few valuable properties. You know, Tumblr and the Yahoo portals and stuff like that are still popular, and the mail. And Verizon can certainly add that to its portfolio and start to extract revenues, particularly in terms of the ad tech.
All right. Well, good luck, Verizon.
Good luck to you if you're on the Verizon network.
Expect some really, really targeted ads.
Yeah, you better. Yeah.
We teased this story a little bit earlier. Cisco wrote a blog, "A Bigger Helping of Internet, Please." So apparently we have yet another open source project. This is called FDIO or FIDO. This was launched by Intel recently. And according to the FIDO site, FIDO is relentlessly focused on data I/O speed and efficiency for more flexible and scalable networks and storage. And Cisco's contribution here is that they've given some software to the project called Vector Packet Processing, VPP. And that is, I guess, a faster virtual router switch.
For those of you who've been following along, we've been using OpenSwitch for the last 5 or 6 years as the heart of most switching engines and routing engines. That's fundamentally an OpenFlow-centric kernel module that goes into Linux that allows you to do virtual switching in the operating system. There's been several criticisms on it. I did a show with the people from PlumGrid talking about their version of the packet acceleration engine. Mm-hmm. And this is Cisco's contribution. And basically, they're taking different ways to get performance out of software switching. So as far as the hardware can go, we want the actual packets to move through the server as fast as possible. Keep in mind that Linux is actually not optimized to send packets in one interface and out another, and nor is the actual hardware, the Intel hardware. And that's why we recently went to the Intel Cloud event last week and posted a blog post. And that's true, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why Intel has been putting a lot of effort into making its, you know, general purpose processor into a packet switching, packet forwarding processor through things like DPDK and some hyperscale other acceleration techniques.
Mm-hmm. So what Cisco's saying is we need a virtual switch that actually goes a hell of a lot faster. And it's teamed up with a bunch of other people, produced the code, and is handing it out for other people to have. It's called Vector Packet Processing. And they've managed to form quite a consortium. They've, at a strategic level, you have a look at the people who have stood up to salute. Cisco, Ericsson, and Intel are platinum members, and then down it's Brocade and Cavium. Everybody's there. Sorry, not everybody, but certainly some good starters. If it is the relentlessly focused on speed and efficiency, and it's targeted to replace Open vSwitch, then we've got something interesting happening. We now have a diversity of virtual switches that you can choose from. So that's now three different choices. And the question is, sadly, customers will find that confusion confusing.
More confusion with your confusion.
Yes. I did pause there because it wasn't a very good piece of grammar, but I'm going to go with it because it worked. It read well. We could argue about the technology and the so forth, but the interesting thing is that the Cisco blog post has published some benchmarking done independently, which seems to be quite convincing. It highlights just how fast VPP is compared to OVS, Open vSwitch, even with the DPDK extensions on board. And keep in mind that this is good for customers, but it's also disruptive to VMware because Open vSwitch has been the heart of many of the things that VMware has been doing. And if Cisco can displace Open vSwitch, it can actually upset VMware's dominance in the virtual switching space. So it's good for Cisco to get this up and get people interested in it.
Yeah, it's interesting to see some competition, and I'm really impressed with the way Intel can draw folks with different competing agendas into open source projects that actually release some interesting stuff.
Well, it's always that, but I think I definitely to see this FIDO, FD.io, as a Cisco-led initiative. And like any good open source foundation, it's not really open unless you've got a bunch of friends along to give you some legitimacy. Yeah. We are scheduled to record a podcast with David Ward in the next few weeks, and we'll have a much deeper dive into that. But I am provisionally quite interested in this. Anything that makes the network faster is good for us. I'm concerned about the conflict with Open vSwitch and the damage that that might cause to open source projects like, you know, OpenStax Neutron or many other networking stacks that are built on these vSwitches. And we might go through a period of disruption and annoyance while open source projects retool if they do decide to build on VPP. Or worse still, many open source projects might be abandoned while they get and restarted so that they can use this new virtual switching technology. And that would be bad for SDN. because that would slow it down and hold back adoption. And that's good for Cisco because Cisco's coming from so far behind on this SDN front, particularly and NFV. So NFV is ultimately the reason why this exists. Don't forget it. Network functions virtualization, the idea of having load balancers and 3G appliances, 4G, 5G appliances all stacked on top of an x86 core. And if Cisco can control the virtual switch, it puts itself in a dominant position for making sure that network functions virtualization in the carrier space is led by initiatives that it's driving and it controls to some degree. You don't control everything in an open source world, but to some extent. So this is a good strategic business move from Cisco. And if it's as technologically superior, then we should use it because it's open source. But be aware that network functions virtualization is on its way. I wouldn't be surprised to find this at the bottom of Cisco's DNA initiative, which I am very, very impressed with. It's the Cisco digital network architecture for the enterprise, where you're using virtual instances instead of physical devices in the enterprise. That's really exciting to me. I keep reading about it and getting the sense that Cisco's not quite onto it. That part of Cisco that's doing the DNA knows what it's doing, but the rest of Cisco's sort of looking at it going like, not so good.
Well, I know I have got to go update my open networking cheat sheet with FDIO and vector packet processing, so there's a little to do for me. Mm. All right, well, that wraps it up for this issue, this edition of Network Break. Greg, if folks want to get more from you, where can they go?
They can find me on Twitter as @EthereumMind. I'm also on LinkedIn. I have a page on Facebook. Feel free to come and follow me on those if that's what your particular thing is. And, of course, I blog reasonably frequently at EthereumMind.com.
And I'm Drew Connery Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net, and you can find me at Drew_CM on Twitter. Thanks again to our sponsors, IT Pro TV and GNS3. Please see all the details about them in our show notes to find out how you can get discounts on training. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you enjoy the show, please like us on Facebook or leave a recommendation on iTunes or share a link with a friend. And you can check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation, if you want to read what we're up to. And you can find the links to those at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.